Listeners are advised that this podcast contains mature themes and addresses issues such as sexual assault, mental health, and pornography.
To breaking news now, a 45-year-old Gold Coast man has been accused of more than 1,500 sex abuse offences against 91 children.
And now to the sex ed book that's been pulled from the shelves and left radio shock jocks hopping mad.
Consent. It's a simple word that's causing a lot of fuss. You'd think understanding its meaning, particularly when it comes to sex, would be clear, yes or no, but it isn't.
There's a common saying that the only things guaranteed in life are death and taxes, but I think we should include sex in its broader sense to that list. The same way we don't feel ashamed to talk to our caregivers about taxes is the way I feel we should be able to discuss sex as a social issue. I came from a household where, I'm sure like many, the subject of sex and our bodies was dismissed, giggled at, or shamed. And the problem with this approach is that those questions don't go away until they're answered. The danger arises when children and teens seek those answers elsewhere or set off into the world unprepared. Now to clarify, when we talk about sex for the purposes of this podcast, we are using it very broadly as a term to cover a whole myriad of issues such as intercourse, sexuality, bodily autonomy, anatomy, biology, consent, and relationships. This in and of itself is an indicator as to why the subject matter has become so difficult to address systematically. The Pandora's box of sexual education has evolved beyond period chats and how to use contraceptives, and it's for this reason that our approach to addressing this subject needs to be advanced as a social issue. So before we dive into the topic and analyse what sexual education is today, let's take a brief look at the evolution of this subject and its delivery over the years. Introduced in the early 60s by way of pamphlets and explainer videos, sexual education was informally introduced in many schools across the country, but it wasn't until more than 30 years later, in the 1990s, that a formal sex education syllabus was implemented as part of school curriculums. Following that trend, it was close to another 30 years before sexual education would once again evolve to include consent as a crucial component of these teachings. Now, while we are very privileged in our Australian school systems to receive some form of sexual education, studies conducted by Act for Kids found that this education isn't nearly consistent or comprehensive enough. Information published by The Educator Australia identified that more than 3/4 of Australians say the sex education they received at school did not prepare them for real life experiences, with less than half saying their education was adequate. Concerningly, more than 1/3 of Aussies say they did not receive any sexual education at school, with less than 1/5 saying they learned about consent and relationships, despite more than 2/3 of Aussies becoming sexually active when they were 18 years old or younger. The research also found 1 in 5 women and 1 in 10 men felt pressured the first time they had sex, illustrating a vital need for more open conversations about sex, consent, relationships, and age-appropriate, evidence-based sexual education. Daniel Principe is a youth advocate and educator with Collective Shout, an organisation that is working against the objectification of women and the sexualisation of girls in media. Daniel's focus is delivering talks to young men around the country about the increasing pornification of culture and how this harms and distorts our social understanding of what it means to be a man. Off the back of a speaking tour in Cairns, Daniel and I caught up, and I was curious to know just how uninformed some young people are in our modern culture about sex and their bodies.
Yeah, I mean, you get from the naive kind of ideas around, you know, I had a boy say to me, he's like, is it true that if you shake my hand, you can tell how much I masturbate? You know, like, you know.
No one would ever shake hands again if that was real.
Yeah, so that was a really interesting, you know, like, oh, I said no. And, you know, I love that he felt confident enough to ask me that. It was more, you know, in private afterwards. And again, that was because it was something that his older brother had said to him. You know, so part of that boy on boy banter, the older brother, you know, trying to throw the younger brother under the bus. And so, yeah, like that's a classic example of like, you know, a bizarre thing that maybe a young person's come to believe. I think the other more confronting elements is when young people don't realize that perhaps someone else not enjoying a particular sex act or something that doesn't cue in for them, that like I need to check in, or you know, they make the assumption that that's something's wrong with the person, not maybe I need to rethink this. So for example, if a young man is wants to engage in a violent sexual act with a young woman because he's seen it in porn or his mates have talked about it and she doesn't want it, he thinks that's a sign that there's something wrong with her. So if she doesn't want to be strangled, or if she doesn't want anal sex, or if she doesn't want to perform, you know, violent oral sex on him, she, you know, he thinks, well, there's something wrong with her.
Now, if we are going to address sexual education as a social issue, it's important to understand our social needs motivating this shift. A report conducted by the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare in 2020 identified some of the social attitudes towards sexual assault in Australia. It found that 1 in 6 women and 1 in 25 men have experienced at least one sexual assault since the age of 15. 1 in 3 people believed that rape resulted from men not being able to control their need for sex, and that 1 in 8 agreed that a man is justified in having non-consensual sex if the woman initiated intimacy in a scenario where a couple had just met. These alarming attitudes highlight a need for a sincere and drastic social shift by way of comprehensive sexual education, especially when we stop to consider how these attitudes may be further enforced by mediums such as pornography.
Yeah, well, let's just make sure we're not misunderstood here. And obviously, sexual assault has always existed and existed well before the advent of modern pornography. However, we have to look at, in particular, why is there such a rise on child sexual assault, where every child wellbeing peak body recognizes this. And in the past, it was perhaps something's happened to the child, you know, has the child, you know, been abused, whereas now more the question asked is, what has this child been exposed to? And they're acting out what they're seeing on another child. And so I think that those are the growing trends, as well as the kind of physical sexual violence that are being presented to, you know, refuges across the country. And again, acts inspired from pornography. So the whole phenomenon of strangulation. Now, people call it choking, but obviously choking is when something gets stuck in your throat. We need to call things what they rightly are, whereas strangulation is obviously with regards to restricting someone's airways and blood vessels to the brain. And that's what's going on. And that's become popular, so much so that I believe that there's a whole domestic violence service that's opened up in Queensland dedicated just to strangulation. And so we have to ask ourselves the question that if, you know, all things that we see on TV, if an advertisement or a political, you know, propaganda can persuade attitudes and ideas, then what does pornography do? And I look at it through that lens, and perhaps not in isolation. There's obviously other things that encompass somebody's attitudes and beliefs and therefore their behaviors, but it's certainly a permission-giving structure. It teaches certain things pretty routinely about violence, about women's place, about degradation, in terms of attitudes, and there's the dehumanizing element to it as well, which therefore makes us a little bit indifferent to the suffering of others. And that's what the research and the Australian Institute of Family Studies report, Our Watchers report from 2020, as well as the National Plan to Address Violence Against Women that came out in December last year, all recognized pornography as a driver of sexual assault, sexual violence as an emboldener of rape myths as well. And so there clearly is some key themes that come away from this. It's not to say that every person that watches pornography will commit sexual assault or sexual violence. I would never say that, and I'm very clear in my talks to clarify that. But I ask the question, but what are we learning? What ideas about sex and sexuality and violence and consent and respect are we learning if this is acting as a default educator and sex educator?
In conducting my research for this episode, I was confronted by just how many social issues can arise as a result of inadequate sex education, such as sexual assault, homophobia, rape, and deviance, just to name a few. But one thing I perhaps naively didn't expect to encounter was the political conflicts which impose limitations or disturb the ability to approach the delivery of sexual education in a consistent, holistic, and open manner. On this topic, I had the opportunity to chat to criminologist and sexual violence researcher Amanda Robertson. Amanda previously worked in the New South Wales education sector, supporting schools to manage various aspects of child protection and safeguarding.
I heard a wonderful presentation recently by Professor Simon Hackett from the UK. He does a lot of work in problematic sexual behaviours in young people, and he was talking about this idea of treating sexual skills, sexual knowledge, like as a skill set to develop over the life course, and that we should treat it like other skills, like communication or emotional regulation or emotional intelligence, that it's something we should be trying to build up in kids, and we should be really proud of them when they are able to exhibit really sound knowledge in this area. And for some reason, because it's, you know, penises and vaginas and all these kinds of things, it's just off, it's a bit taboo and yucky, and people don't really want to talk about it, or they're scared to talk about it. They don't know what language to use. I think most people would say they want the best for their kids. And so that it's not so much about trying to set their kids up to fail. It's that maybe they don't feel well equipped to have these kinds of conversations if we're talking about broader sex ed and not just in schools. And then I think when we're talking about schools specifically, obviously that just becomes far more political, because the non-government sector is, some of those schools are heavily influenced by religion, and then that gets trickier.
Yeah, that makes sense. So you co-authored an article for The Conversation following the arrest of a 45-year-old childcare worker who was charged with more than 1,600 counts of child abuse. As a method to preventing child sexual assault, the article suggests teaching children appropriate terminology for body parts and basic rules about safe and unsafe behaviours, which is a form of early sex ed. Some groups share their concern over burdening young children with such information and asking children to bear the responsibility for what is done to them. Mm-hmm. Is there a way to appease both sides when providing sexual education to children?
Mm. I completely understand that we don't want to have the expectation to be on children and young people that they prevent their own abuse, is my first thing. There's usually always an and that comes with statements. And we know from inquiries such as the Royal Commission and the independent inquiry that came out of the UK, very similar to our Royal Commission, is that there was a clear message from victims that they are saying now as adults in the present day that they wish they knew more about healthy sexual behaviours and sexual abuse and what was normal, so that they could have detected that this was abnormal and disclosed then, to help them realise that these are problematic behaviours to tell someone about. So I think it is an important piece of a bigger puzzle. It is not the only piece of the puzzle, and it is on adults to be teaching kids those messages, number one, to be creating relationships where they can disclose safely, number two, and then to act responsibly on those disclosures when they're received. So I think it can still be, I think even though it is about educating and upskilling kids, the onus is still on adults to be doing that and to be responding to that. In terms of teaching kids appropriate body names for their genitalia, I mean, that's just an everyday thing. That's not a class. That's not a program delivery. That's just embedding in everyday life. And I just don't think it's outrageous to call a vagina a vagina. I don't really understand how that's contentious or problematic. If your child goes to the doctor, that's what the doctor's going to call it.
These sentiments were beautifully echoed by my next guest, Dr. Simon Denny. Dr. Denny is an associate professor specialising in paediatrics with Mater Health in Brisbane.
I think about sexual education amongst that broader thing about relationships. And in some sense, you know, there's a huge amount of research now that shows that we do need to teach young people about their relationships and their emotional well-being, because that comes into relationships, right? Or what they call social emotional learning. You know, all this comes under that broad umbrella of so we're not just teaching reading and writing at schools, we're teaching a whole bunch broader than that. And educators get this, you know. I work with teachers and have for decades, and you know, good teachers, they're right on the same page as I am when we think about, you know, think about this. So yeah, they need sexual education in that broad sense right from a young age, right from, as I was saying with my daughter, you know, they need to learn names of body parts, they need to understand their own biology, and then that leads into thinking, you know, talking about relationships and their own emotional well-being and others people's emotional well-being, and it just builds on there. So all these programs need to start from the moment they hit schools. Schools are a great place to learn this, as well as families. And it needs to be sort of progressive across those school years, right from year dot.
As part of Dr. Denny's research, he conducted a study across 96 schools in New Zealand on the mental health impacts of sexual minority or LGBTQI plus students who attended inclusive and supportive schools. The study used determinants such as school organisational structures and positive teacher-adult relationships to establish whether a particular school would be considered supportive where sexual minority students are concerned. I was interested to ask Dr. Denny whether he believes comprehensive sexual education, which adequately covers topics such as sexuality, would further contribute to creating a supportive and safe space for sexual minority students.
Well, I mean, if you don't include sexual diversity and gender diversity as part of that instruction, then you're ignoring, what, 10% of your student body, up to 20% maybe, if you include neurodiversity in the full spectrum. And what does that mean if you feel like you're not being part of things? It's bad for your mental health. So, no, we desperately need to include the full and acknowledge sexual minority or gender diverse people.
So whether it's as a means of reducing rates of sexual assaults, protecting children from predatory behaviour, or improving the mental health of LGBTQI people, these social improvements alone clearly demonstrate the necessity for comprehensive sexual education. As the former Secretary General of the United Nations, Kofi Annan, once stated, "Knowledge is power, information is liberating, and education is the premise of progress in every society, in every family." By shifting our attitudes and weaving this education into our social fabric, we can remove the stigmas that allow so many of these issues to go unchecked. Rather than a divisive subject with limitations imposed by religious or political beliefs, sexual education can be used as a tool for positive social change.